20 days, one historic move, an unbelievable journey. Melania from the Amazon MGM Studios captures the one-of-a-kind transition into the White House, showcasing the planning, the pressure, and personal moments that come with stepping into the role of the First Lady for a second time. From logistical complexities to decisions made behind closed doors, the film brings you closer to Mrs. Trump and her family as they return to the nation's capital. See what history looks like before the doors officially open. Melania arrives exclusively in theaters January 30th, 2026.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
This is the great Brian Kilmeade Show. Your humble D.C. correspondent, Griff Jenkins, filling in on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Brian has the day off, and it comes in a news cycle. You know, typically this is the time of year, late January, when the weather begins to really suck, and the holidays are over, and there's nothing really on the horizon, so you get comfortable and sort of settle into some blasé cold days, maybe catch up on Netflix. Watch some TV. Not in this news cycle, baby. This has been a fire hydrant of news. And it's not only your humble DC correspondent, Griff Jenkins, filling in for Brian Kilmeade, but if you haven't noticed, my colleague on weekends on Fox and Friends, Charlie Hurt, and I have taken over operations in New York. We've just stormed it. You had us on the couch on either side of Ainsley the last few days, and now joining me in the studio on the Brian Kilmeade Show is Charlie Hurt. Hey, Charlie.
Yeah, we really did kind of take over the weekday and stunk up the place, I would like
to
think.
Do you think they noticed?
Yeah. The ratings just nosedived, I'm sure.
Probably.
Yeah.
Except
we got to talk to Lawrence today. We did a health check-in with Lawrence this morning. He's doing much better. He's had his eye surgery, and it sounds like we should be able to get him back before too long.
We should, and prayers and thoughts for Lawrence, who's doing great, had a detached retina, had surgery, and he can't wait to get back, and we can't wait to have him back and spare our viewers of you and I sitting on the couch.
Right.
I will say this, though. To your point that the ratings may have pummeled, probably not yesterday, because we had that Tom Homan.
We've been
Homan,
buoyed by news.
We had that live Tom Homan news conference, and you know, for listeners out there, Charlie Hurt and I have covered the news in Washington and elsewhere for decades, sadly, to date ourselves as middle-aged men in our 50s. And, you know, what Tom Homan did is, without exaggeration, remarkable. He leaned into a situation that had become untenable, a situation that began on January 20th in 2021, when the previous president, Joe Biden, came in and opened the border in an unprecedented way, couldn't control it, lied to us about it being secure when it wasn't. And now this administration, this President Trump, is trying to clean it up, shutting the border down and now removing the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of violent criminal illegal aliens that have infiltrated cities, particularly in sanctuary cities, when they choose not to cooperate with federal law enforcement to remove them, but yet turns them loose on the streets. But Tom Homan realized, after the shootings of Renee Good and Alex Preddy, that something needed to be done. They needed to get back to where the purpose and the main focus and mission of ICE is, which is to remove those criminal aliens. And, you know, he took a sober, calm, straightforward approach to it that really not only has reset, I think, the table, but put the onus on the leaders in Minneapolis, Mayor Fry, the governor, Tim Walz, who have played this absolutely to the degree of inciting those protesters into agitators. Here is a little bit of what Tom Homan was trying to talk about, what he is doing as the point person that President Trump put there. Cut one.
President Trump promised American people, including the residents of Minnesota, that he would work to ensure our communities are safe. And with that, this administration is absolutely focused on identifying removal aliens that pose a public safety threat and national security threats.
I mean, Charlie, how do Minneapolis leaders, Walz, Fry, Ellison, others, deny that that is what the public Minnesotans would want?
Yeah, it's really incredible to think about how the degree to which people like Jacob Frey and Tim Walz have created the atmosphere in which you have basically war zones in American cities where ICE agents who are not there for the funsies, they're there because they have an obligation. It's not a choice. It's an obligation to enforce federal laws that are on the books because politicians, including many Democrats like Tim Walz and Jacob Frey, though maybe they didn't vote for these particular things because they've never been in Congress, but they are laws that are on the books that ICE agents, federal agents do not have a choice. President Trump does not have a choice but to enforce. And the idea that you have politicians in a place like Minneapolis and in other cities around the country who have decided that, you know what, we don't like those laws. We don't have the political will in this country to change those laws, but we're just going to violate the laws and encourage our supporters to go out and blatantly confront ICE agents and create this really hostile atmosphere where you wind up with some of these protesters getting killed. And the onus, if we took out the all of the political rhetoric, all of the political discussion today, and you just looked at this, a jury looked at this from the outside with just the bare facts, they would say the only people responsible for these deaths, the only politicians responsible for these deaths are politicians like Jacob Frey and Tim Walz and others around the country who have fomented this rage against ICE agents, federal agents who are simply there enforcing the law. They don't have a choice about it. It's not an option of theirs. It is a requirement when they took the oath of office.
And I think you put the perfect word to it, Charlie, when you said obligation. It's an obligation. And I think, as you know, some might misread the situation. Some in the media are saying Kristi Noem is sidelined. Kristi Noem is knocked aside. But President Trump said, no. We shake things up all the time.
Yeah.
What we're doing is putting Tom Homan in charge to bring some calm to the chaos and work with the leaders there, Frey, Walz, and others. And Bovino is out. He's gone back to the El Sector Center where he was the Border Patrol chief in that sector prior to this. But this whole notion, and President Trump said that he was asked point blank, is Kristi Noem, is her day's number? He said, no, she's not. Yeah. That's not the case. She's done a great job at DHS carrying out my administration's goals and mission with regards to DHS. And as in this case, and with ICE. Last night, Kristi Noem speaking out for the first time after this all happened to our own pal, Sean Hannity. And, you know, I thought that she did a good job really reiterating the same message that President Trump has given, the same message that Tom Homan gave, which is what it is that Tim Walz and Jacob Frey need to understand. Listen to this. Cut six.
Yeah, I would tell them to be leaders and to change their rhetoric because it is encouraging the kind of violence that we see on their streets today. Their riots are attacking our officers not just when they're doing their work, but even at night at their hotels. And they haven't allowed their law enforcement to keep them safe. Even while they're off shift, they can't go to restaurants. They can't operate safely. They've had their lives threatened and their families' lives threatened. So I would encourage the governor to work with us, the mayor to work with us to get those dangerous criminals off the streets. That's all we want.
Okay, so that's her message. Obviously, it's the same as Tom Homan and President Trump's inter. We both have children in their 20s. And throughout raising children, you sometimes back up, you know, reset the table and make it very clear what the understanding is for the child to understand. And I don't mean to be, you know, flippant about suggesting that Mayor Frey is acting like a child here, but what happens? Jacob Frey goes to Washington at the mayor's conference. He's one of the keynote speakers, a lot of attention on him. And you would think he would have some sort of language that would suggest to you that he understands what he has been told, kind of like a child that you've redundantly explained the situation to. But yet he's making comments, Charlie, like this, that really shocked me to hear this. This is cut eight. Play this.
We are on the front lines of a very important battle. And it's important that we aren't silenced, that we aren't put down. This is not a time to bend our heads in despair or out of fear that we may be next. Because if we do not speak up, If we do not step out, it will be your city that is next.
You know, I have a hard time gauging right at the moment whether this kind of rhetoric is breaking through in a big way to like normal voters. But Jacob Fry and Democrats better hope it doesn't. Because if that sort of rhetoric actually breaks through and colors the midterm elections, then President Trump and Republicans are going to do something pretty historic here, and they're going to widen their majorities in both chambers of Congress, despite all of the headwinds going against the party that is in power normally. This kind of they are on the losingest side of this fight. And it, just the language he's using right there, he's using the language of an activist. He's using the language of a radical activist who doesn't believe that the laws should be enforced. Meanwhile, you have President Trump over here, who is the adult. Jacob Fry is definitely the child. You have Donald Trump, who is the adult, and he watched what happened was happening in Minneapolis. He was doing everything that he is obligated to do, enforcing the law. So were his ICE agents. But he also recognized that he didn't like what the outcome was. It wasn't his fault. It wasn't the agent's fault. But he didn't like the outcome. And like an adult, he swallowed hard and decided to do a tactical reset. And by replacing with Tom Homan, you have Tom Homan, who anybody who thinks that Tom Homan is not tough on border security, who's not tough on enforcing immigration laws, hasn't been paying attention. So Tom Homan goes out there and tries to do a tactical reset. They're not going to not continue enforcing laws. They're going to continue to do it. But Donald Trump does not want to see people getting killed. And if this whole rhetoric, this all this debate, and again, I'm not sure that how far it breaks past, you know, you and I talk about it every day, for hours every day. I don't know how much of it has broken out into like the normal electorate. It takes a while to sort of gauge that. But if it does, Donald Trump and Republicans will win massively. And the Tim Walz and Jacob Fries, who, by the way, have taken over the National Democrat Party. You've got Hakeem Jeffries and Chuck Schumer shutting down the government, the federal government, tonight because they want to at least partially defund ICE. They want to defund these operations. They are on the losingest side of this.
100%. And not only that, we've pointed out to our viewers who may not understand how the politics work in Washington, this shutdown will be futile to accomplishing Hakeem Jeffries' goal because the big, beautiful bill funds $75 billion funding ICE through 2029. So the funding stream isn't being cut off. They shut the government down. They're basically just going to cobble our poor TSA workers and FEMA and some active military could see pay cuts. And, you know, I love that you were talking about, you know, whether or not Democrats think that they're getting the soft guy out of all this.
Right.
And Tom Homan, you said the other day, I thought it was awesome on Fox and Friends. You said, yeah, he's like a velvet hammer. Yeah. And that's exactly what's coming. But to your point about the midterms, it's great. This morning, we were covering some of the recent polls. And I know you question polls. I totally share your sentiment about, you know, polling and how they ask the question. But overall, it's got Republicans plus 15 on immigration. So whether or not this is breaking through, which I think is such an interesting point you're making, it is clear that the sentiment that delivered a victory for President Trump on what I would argue is the top issue of immigration in 2024 still remains. And you have not only Fry and Walz re-upping this activist fight, fight, fight language, but you do have members of Congress, Pramila Jayapal, AOC, others, even Hakeem Jeffries the other day talking about putting Kristi Noem on ICE, calling for the abolishment of ICE, abolish ICE. And at the end of the day, what that would break through, I think, to viewers or to listeners in the public would be that they are, okay, so you're anti-law enforcement. At the end of the day, it's anti-law enforcement.
Well, and honestly, I mean, that's my biggest concern right now in places like Minneapolis. I think it's just so fundamentally unfair to send these ICE agents into neighborhoods that politicians have turned into war zones for political purpose. It's so unfair to send them out there to do what is, in the best of circumstances, is a difficult job. But under these circumstances, It's an impossible job. And the idea that somehow, and of course, it's the agents who wind up paying the price for it. They're the ones that wind up in horrible situations where they're having to defend themselves in ways that they don't want to have to defend themselves in those ways. And you have these horrible outcomes. And it's not the agent's fault. It's Tim Walz's fault. Yeah. It's Jacob Fry's fault, 100%. And I think, quite frankly, I think that's one of the reasons that President Trump wanted to do this tactical reset is because he looks at this and he's like, no, I don't want my agents having to bear the burden of these horrific decisions that are being made by politicians.
And it's such a good point because these agents are humans with families, or mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters. And I am going to tell you about riding along with one in Maine last week and the horrific doxing that's occurring. I'll get into that when we come back. But first, Charlie Hurd, thank you very much.
Great
catch
to see
us this weekend Fox Sports. We have some awesome guests, neither of which Charlie and I can promo, other than we know that Rachel has an interview with Melania Trump. This is Griff Jenkins filling on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
I said in March, if the rhetoric didn't stop, there's going to be bloodshed. And there has been. I wish I wasn't right. I don't want to see anybody die. Not officers, not members of the community, and not the targets of our operations. For the people out there that don't like what ICE is doing, if you want certain laws reformed, then take it up with Congress. Again, ICE is making this up. They're enforcing laws enacted by Congress and signed by the president. The same laws have been on the books for the last six presidents I worked for.
This is Griff Jenkins filling in for the Brian Kilmeade Show. A somber moment there from Tom Homan, border czar, out in Minneapolis at the press conference yesterday, talking about, and he actually got choked up, moved, because I've known Tom Homan for 20 years. And, you know, Tom Homan is someone who is a lifelong dedicated servant to the security of our nation. And you cannot overstate. And by the way, many of you familiar have seen on social media and elsewhere, this is the same guy who ran ICE's ERO, the Enforcement and Removal Operations. These are the same officers that are now trying to remove criminal illegal aliens from our streets. He held that job as the point man in 2008, 2009 under President Obama, who had far more deportations than this administration, and yet he is out there doing the same thing he was doing in 2009 when President Obama gave him the presidential medal, an award for his service and excellence, doing the same thing now. And yet at the same time, it hits home. I understand what he's feeling in such a small way. Last week I was in Maine riding along as they conducted their new operations, going after criminal illegal aliens in Portland, Maine, and surrounding towns. And the agent riding in the car with me showed me a picture. He had been doxxed on an ICE watch bulletin board online, had a picture of his family, his children, his dog, and the person underneath it wrote, "Nothing a sniper can't take out. I say kill the whole family." That agent is impacted. This is real, and it's got to stop. Griff Jenkins here on the Brian Kilmeade Show. A lot more when we come back.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Well, I think the White House realizes that they made a huge mistake to let this agency go rogue in Minneapolis with two dead Americans because of it.
And the Karen wing of the party wants to defund ICE just like they wanted to defund the police. Therefore, the Democrats have got to vote against the bill.
So while I am very glad to see the White House and Republicans are now talking with Democrats to finalize a plan to pass the five bills and split off DHS, until that deal is finalized, I will be a no on this vote.
I'm willing to entertain some reforms to make sure that we rein in ICE appropriately and make it more professional. But the cancer that we're dealing with is sanctuary city policy.
This is Griff Jenkins filling in for Brian Kilmeade on the Great Brian Kilmeade Show. A Friday just getting hammered with news and, of course, the possibility of a government shutdown. You heard it here. Another government shutdown the Democrats are willing to actually force upon us starting at midnight tonight. Joining us on the line, Representative David Kustoff, the great congressman from Tennessee. Congressman, as a fellow Tennessean born and raised in Memphis, I am always partial to bring Tennesseans on. How are you?
Griff, good morning. Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me this morning. It's cold in Tennessee, and unfortunately, with the snow and the ice, we've had a lot of people impacted in our community, just like they are across the nation. But we're looking forward to a warm-up and looking forward to power being restored in places like Nashville, which has suffered for 6 days now.
You know, Congressman, my older brother's family still live in Memphis, and I have followed closely, hosting Fox and Friends all this week, covering the story. Tennessee, among the hardest, if not the hardest hit, and I talked to some of the amazing linemen that are out there, true unsung heroes. When storms hit, linemen race into danger, and I want to get to that. But before I do, we played there for you in the intro, just a montage of Democrats and Republican members of the Senate, your colleagues in the other chamber, talking about this government shutdown, which it appears we're staring it in the face. And there's just so many things I could say about this. And by the way, just so our listeners understand, at this point, the only way that a government shutdown is avoided is if the Senate would vote on all six bills as one, which is how it was sent from your chamber of the House over to the Senate. They want to break it off. That's going to lead to at least a partial shutdown with a caveat, an irony of sorts, which is Democrats think that by shutting the government down, they're going to somehow cut off funds for ICE when actually, when you look at the facts of it, ICE is already funded through 2029 with $75 billion. So actually, it's only going to impact other parts of the government like FEMA, like TSA, active duty military members in some cases. But what do you make of the prospect of the shutdown? Do you think it's probably, as I'm characterizing it, inevitable, at least for a short period of time at best?
Well, Griff, I think it's ridiculous, and I think it's hypocritical. Because if you think about when I took a vote in the House of Representatives last week to keep the government, to fund the government through September the 30th, Homeland Security was part of the deal. And the reason it's hypocritical is that because the Democrats in the House and the Senate, those who helped craft the appropriations bill, they signed off on it. These Democrats signed off on the bill that we voted on in the House of Representatives last week that now the Democrats in the Senate want to tear apart and strip from the remaining five bills. So it's wrong on behalf of the Democrats to do this. And I think one thing that we learned in the 43 days in October and November when the government shutdown is it benefits nobody. It certainly doesn't benefit our constituents. It doesn't benefit the government employees. The Senate is likely to take another vote, hopefully later this morning, to try to at least vote on five of the six bills, not Homeland Security, to keep the government functioning and to fund the government through September the 30th. I'd like to think that we can avoid a shutdown, but if we do have a shutdown, and I'll remind your listeners that this funding runs through midnight tonight. Mm-hmm. If we shut down, this is all on the backs of the Democrats.
Well, that's my question, Congressman. I mean, really, you know, I can't imagine that anyone in Washington has any sort of appetite for a government shutdown. The last one did not go over well, overwhelmingly. And now, unlike the last one, we're in an election year, the midterms. If we have a prolonged shutdown, or even one that costs paychecks for hardworking Americans serving the country, that's going to hurt one party or the other, certainly in the midterms. Do you see it hurting Republicans or Democrats?
Well, if we shut down, I'm going to remind every one of my constituents and everybody that I talk to that it's the fault of the Democrats if the government were to shut down. You know, take out ICE, take out other law enforcement agents. These TSA agents that people deal with and they interact with in the airport all the time, whose paychecks were affected in October and November, they would be subject to having their pay withheld and not being paid if the government were to shut down. And think about that, Griff, over the last week or so, where we've seen air travel impacted significantly because of the weather, and these TSA agents have worked bravely during this time. Can you imagine asking these men and women in the Coast Guard, everybody else who's funded through Homeland Security, that they're expected to go to work and work diligently but not get paid?
It's preposterous, the fact that Americans just went through the storm, which just absolutely canceled in one day. We saw thousands of cancellations, lots and lots of delays. Anyone wants to do that again by impacting it? So walk me through just a little bit. If indeed the Senate passes something and they break off DHS, so they pass five, one remains that they're going to try and work. And Lindsey Graham is saying, you know, listen, we'll hear you out on reforms. We're not going to take masks off of agents that are being doxxed ridiculously. I just talked about one I was with in Maine when I was reporting, riding along with Maine. He was being doxxed, a lunatic out there calling for a sniper to take out his family. This has reached an untenable level. It's out of control. But setting that aside, walk me through, if the Senate passes something, you guys aren't currently in session today, what would be next?
So what the Senate wants to do, or what they've talked about doing, and what Leader Thune has talked about doing, is passing five appropriation bills that we passed in the House last week, pass them out, split off Homeland Security, and fund that temporarily for 2 weeks as a continuing resolution for 2 weeks while he tries to work with Chuck Schumer and Democrats to see what type of, I'm using the word reforms because I think that's the word they've used, what reforms
correct.
They want to Homeland Security. You pointed out one that the Democrats have demanded, and that is that these ICE agents not be allowed to wear their masks. They have to wear masks now, unfortunately, because there are Democrat activists across the country, these far-left activists who are targeting ICE agents and their families. And so those men and women who are doing their jobs, they've got to be able to do their jobs, but do it where it doesn't affect their safety and their security. So I would think for Republicans in the Senate, if that's a demand of the Democrats for these ICE agents to remove their masks, that's a non-starter.
And if they do, if the Senate passes the break-off, the five with the one DHS for funding for 2 weeks, do you think there's an appetite in the House that would pass that?
I think the House of Representatives, the Republicans in the House, are going to be very critical mm-hmm. of whatever comes back. Because, again, we did our job last week. We did what we were asked to do. And, again, we did what the Democrats those appropriators agreed to and signed off on. It was only after we passed it that they moved the goalpost and tried to change the rules. So we'd have to see what the Senate comes back with. But I don't think there's much appetite in the House right now to change anything. And then one other question, Griff, is not only Republicans, but are the Democrats in the House going to agree to any changes that come over from the Senate? So there are a lot of question marks. I would just submit, though, that Republicans in the House did what we were supposed to do a week ago, and it's too bad that the Democrats in the Senate have put us and the people in this nation in the situation as you and I talk right now.
We're talking to Congressman David Kustoff of the great state of Tennessee. And Congressman, I do want to talk about the other ice, the actual Mother Nature ice, in the damage that this ice storm has wreaked on the volunteer state in Tennessee. And earlier this week, I was interviewing Congressman, two linemen from Middle Valley, Tennessee, that are out there. They're working around the clock, and one of the guys, one of the linemen, had 35 years of experience. He says he's never seen a storm like this. Talk to me about where things stand now in Tennessee, how you're dealing with you know, the situation as it stands, power outages, getting people, you know, heat in their homes.
So, Griff, we know that this storm was really unprecedented for our region of the country. I had one of my county mayors, and I represent 20 different counties in Tennessee. He's been a mayor for over 20 years, and he told me, he said, David, I've never seen a weather incident like what we've seen now, and he's dealt with tornadoes and all sorts of weather calamities. In Nashville, and I don't represent Nashville, they started out with almost half of their account holders, half of their homes, not have power. 6 days later, they still have 70,000 plus in Nashville that don't have power. So it's a tough situation. I'll remind people, as you and I talked about with Department of Homeland Security, we've got FEMA funding that's part of this whole package. Well, we need FEMA funding and FEMA resources in Tennessee. We need it all across the South. And that's another reason to make sure that this government doesn't shut down at midnight tonight.
Well, that's very important, Congressman. I'm not sure people have thought about that. So if the government shuts down, the FEMA support, resources, and funding that you desperately need in Tennessee and Mississippi and other areas impacted by this storm, you would actually be in jeopardy of those resources and funding immediately coming to you?
That's right, because that funding comes from Homeland Security. So we've got to make sure that the government doesn't shut down. Hopefully the Senate will do their job. The House right now is not scheduled to come back until Monday. That would be our first time to vote. So even if the Senate does what it should do, they've changed what the House voted on. And we all know civics. The House would have to ratify the next thing. So we could be under a potential partial shutdown for a day or 2 days. And again, this is all very fluid. We'll know more once the Senate does whatever they may do later today. And we'll get instructions from Speaker Johnson about when our next vote will be in the House of Representatives.
Well, I am glad you have raised that, Congressman Kustoff, because that is a significant and damning impact of the shutdown as everyone's thinking about ice and the whole fight over what's happening in Minneapolis. This is real life. And I'm partial because I'm a Tennessean. But for everyone in the country that realizes that, you know, desperate needed resources and funding must quickly get there, you know, I want to give you a chance, by the way, because I talked about them. They're truly the unsung heroes. people don't fully understand just how amazing these linemen are that are out on those power lines, because the unprecedented storm, as you rightfully point out, has created so much ice that is causing trees to explode. But these trees are taking down the power lines. Power is going down. And as soon as sometimes they put those lines back up, there's a refreeze because the temperatures continue to plummet and be frozen. And so it's complicating the problem. But I want to give you a chance to speak about, you know, these linemen, because honestly, most Americans, in fact, pretty much all Americans, save a live shot of a reporter out there, don't see the heroic work that they're doing. And they, by the way, I talked to one, by the way, that was literally out there working on the line 16 hours a day and told me actually his family did not have power at home. So he left his home where his family had no power to go out and work on the line.
Griff, these men and women, these linemen who are in Tennessee, and they actually are here from other places. I have not talked about North Mississippi, which is severely impacted by power outages and traffic snafus. These linemen are really doing heroic work trying to get power restored to a lot of people who, again, who have not had power for 5 and 6 days. And as you and I talk right now, in my part of Tennessee, it's 26 degrees. So they are out there in frigid conditions with ice all over the place, on the ground and in trees and what have you. So we applaud their work. We appreciate their work. And, you know, we've got looks like another winter storm that may affect the East Coast this weekend. So say a prayer for these men and women who are really doing very important work, trying to make sure that we all can stay warm in our homes and our businesses.
I appreciate you mentioning Northern Mississippi, Congressman. I'm a kid from Memphis that went to Ole Miss. Oxford has gotten decimated. So very sincerely, my heart and my prayers go out to those in North Mississippi and Tennessee and everywhere else impacted. And we pray that this storm won't bring further complications, or that the government won't shut down to stop and important, critical resources and funding to come to those hard-hit areas. Congressman David Kustoff, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming on. As always, you have an open-ended invitation here on the Great Brian Kilmeade Show. Have a great weekend, sir.
Thank you, Griff. Thank you for having me today.
All right. That's Congressman David Kustoff from Tennessee on the Brian Kilmeade Show. I am your humble D.C. correspondent, Griff Jenkins, trying to live into the great big shoes of Brian Kilmeade. We've got a whole lot more when we come back.
The headlines, the stories behind them, and the people who make them. Only on the Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, we want to avoid a government shutdown, but it's necessary to ensure that the Department of Homeland Security dramatically changes the way in which it has been conducting itself. Taxpayer dollars should be used to address the affordability crisis here in the United States of America, which is very real. It's not a hoax. It's ongoing, by the way. Taxpayer dollars should not be used to brutalize or kill American citizens or to violently target law-abiding immigrant families. So there are a variety of reforms that need to be put into place that the American people are demanding.
That is the House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries saying he doesn't want a shutdown. I'm Griff Jenkins, filling in for Brian Kilmeade, and I cannot believe we're headed for another shutdown. You just heard from Congressman David Kustoff, who says this would be terrible. Hakeem, what are you thinking? I don't know. We'll see where it goes. It's crazy times here on the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm Griff Jenkins.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
The fastest and the best radio show in the country. Brian Kilmeade with the day off. It is your humble D.C. correspondent, Griff Jenkins, trying to fill the great shoes of Brian Kilmeade on a Friday in late January that is frigid and might be a bit of a slow day, but not so in this news cycle. And all eyes are on Minnesota and the fallout from the chaos that is happening in Minnesota. And because I have spent more than a decade covering the border, covering the chaotic years of the Biden administration, it is impossible for me, whether I am filling in on Fox and Friends, talking on the weekend in the anchor chair, or here on Brian Kilmeade's show, to not constantly remind people of how we got here. The tragic death of Alex Pretty, before that of Renee Good. That road begins on January 20th, 2021, when Joe Biden came in and on day one undid more than 90 executive orders that President Trump in his first term put in place that secured our border and brought a safety to our country from the threat of violent criminal illegal aliens. He had Remain in Mexico. He had wall construction. I could speak for another 30 minutes about the things that he had put in place in the first Trump administration. And believe me, I knew the threat because not once, but twice, you may recall, I traveled to Honduras and walked 7,000 miles through the entirety of Honduras, through the entirety of Guatemala, across the Suchiate River, into Tapachula, Mexico, in the breadth and length of Mexico, all the way to our borders. And I watched migrants coming in droves. Then you got the Biden administration, where they opened the border in a reckless, unprecedentedly dangerous way. And that is how we ended up with 10 million plus being crossing and being allowed into our country, 2 million known gotaways. And you wonder, why did they not want to just take the free pass to cross and be given a free asylum slip to just get free health care, free food, a flight to any city they wanted? It's a good deal. The Biden administration was giving it away. It was causing a pull factor from every country on the planet of unprecedented number of migrants to come. Why did the known gotaways not want to identify themselves? Well, many suggest it's because they would be identified as criminals. So here we are now, with the chaos that has ensued after literally weeks and months of incitement from the local leaders in Minneapolis, the mayor, Jacob Frey, the governor, Tim Walz, inciting what were perhaps First Amendment protesters, moved into agitation that were breaking literally federal laws by impeding, assaulting, or obstructing federal immigration law enforcement. People forget all the time how this works. CBP, Customs and Border Protection, oversees two entities, Border Patrol and ICE. Border Patrol are the men and women in green that bravely secure our borders in the northern border and, of course, the southern border. They deal with the borders. ICE deals with removing criminal illegal aliens, many of them violent, from the interior. Now, after securing the border in an unprecedented and historic way that President Trump has done with straight 8 months of zero releases, the job is cleaning up what's in the interior. And when Tom Homan gave that press conference yesterday, I have called it multiple times and I'll continue to do it, masterclass of trying to reset and refocus people to understand the threat. And the reason why it's masterclass is he put the onus on the leaders in Minnesota by simply saying, give us your criminals. We're not asking you to do our job of federal law enforcement. We're asking you to cooperate because they are in Minneapolis, a sanctuary jurisdiction, no matter what they call it. They call it a separation ordinance. It is a sanctuary jurisdiction. And this is one quick soundbite that I thought really stood out to the heart of what Borders Are Tom Homan's trying to do. This is cut four. Listen here.
To be clear, we did not agree with Minnesota state and local officials that they would be involved in immigration enforcement. I didn't ask them to be immigration officers. I'm asking them to be cops working with the cops to help us take criminal aliens off the street. What we did agree upon is not to release public safety arrests back in the community when they could be lawfully transferred to ICE.
Joining us now, Ken Cuccinelli, former acting DHS deputy secretary and the senior fellow for immigration and homeland security at the Center for Renewing America. Ken, thank you for joining us here on the Brian Kilmeade Show. And, you know, you look at this and you think, how do Minnesota leaders not take that deal? You've got to believe Minnesotans look at it, see that Tom Homan is focused on public safety threats and would want their leaders to take this deal.
Griff, there you go, thinking logically. that's the starting error when analyzing the Tim Walz's of the world. It's hard for most Americans, you and I are in this bucket, but so is the vast majority of Americans, to understand that people like Tim Walz and Mayor Fry, they actually want the violence and chaos. This is not an error. This is not a problem. This is actually a useful political tool to them. Now, it's gotten out of hand. It's gotten out of control, as such things virtually always do. And so now they're, after letting these violent horses out of the barn, they're trying to calm them down. And, you know, that's a lot harder to do than to avoid the problem in the first place. And Tom Homan, as you noted, I watched that same press conference, put on a master class. And people who know Tom Homan, you know him from Fox. I've known him for years. He is a tough nut. He is not a natural diplomat, but he's a very self-disciplined, very experienced law enforcement officer. And he displayed calm, cool, collected common sense in that press conference yesterday. And his engagement with the people in Minnesota, who, as he noted, we don't agree on many things, but we do agree that people should be kept safe. Well, I hope the other side agrees with that now that they've lost control of the situation. And I think Tom is the guy to bring it back under control. And he's already doing a good job of that. And he's given them an off-ramp. He's given them a way out that makes their people safer and reduces the number of ICE agents in Minnesota and Minneapolis, because they'll still be able to accomplish their mission if Minnesota finally agrees to do what President Trump asked them to do a year ago.
Which is simply to cooperate. And by the way, Ken, you talk about the history of Tom Homan. I love to remind viewers and listeners that Tom Homan was given the Presidential Medal as the acting ICE ERO, Enforcement and Removal Operations guy, under President Obama, back when Democrats were more common sense forward thinking that having illegal criminal aliens in the country are a public safety threat. Yeah. And, you know, it is interesting. I really thought that, you know, when Mayor Fry came to Washington yesterday for the mayor's conference, that we would hear a different tone from him. But yet this one soundbite really is shocking to me. Ken, here is a little bit of what he had to say yesterday. This is cut eight. Listen to the way he talks and the language he uses.
We are on the front lines of a very important battle. And it's important that we aren't silenced, that we aren't put down. This is not a time to bend our heads in despair or out of fear that we may be next. Because if we do not speak up, if we do not step out, it will be your city that is next.
I was floored that that's the rhetoric he's continuing to use.
Yeah, again, he's talking to a very narrow audience, and the rest of America needs to understand what he's doing makes sense to him in his little far left wing communist violent bubble. He is trying to be the guy Antifa supports. Well, he's succeeding at being the guy Antifa supports, but 85% of America thinks Antifa are a bunch of terrorists, and they are. They may not do what the terrorists of 9/11 did, but they do low-level intentional violence. They threaten and harm law enforcement officers. He wants to use battlefield analogies, so let's use a battlefield analogy. If you're against a war, you don't show up and wander around on the battlefield and tell people you're, quote, protesting. Guess what happens? You get blown up. and not because we're aiming at you, but because it's a battlefield. And these people who want to call themselves protesters, who are invading churches, who are stalking law enforcement while they're conducting law enforcement operations, that is not how you protest. You're no longer a protester. You're an obstructor, and it is legitimate as a simple legal matter to call you an agitator and obstructionist. That's not where First Amendment rights are exercised. That's where law enforcement takes place. And these agents, they just want to go home to their family at night. And they want their family to be safe, of course. They don't know what each of these individual Alex Preddies of the world has in mind. They don't know what he's going to do with that gun. It may have been perfectly legal for him to carry the gun. I'm a big Second Amendment supporter. But the fact of the matter is, if you're an agent in that situation, you've seen this guy before. You don't know which one's the crazy one. You don't know which one's going to pull that gun out and just start shooting. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty rough work environment to try to operate in. I saw a statistic on Twitter earlier this week. Guy went through the data, ICE's data, and found that two-thirds of their officer-involved violence in the last year had occurred in just 9 counties out of over 3,100 counties in the United States. So that tells you it's not ICE.
Yeah.
It's the people organizing to be violent and confront ICE as they do their job, a job enforcing the law that Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, and Chuck Schumer all voted for.
Yeah, and you talk about these agitators, and I think your analogy is so true. You know, look, you can stand, and in fact, you know, we fight wars. Men and women fight and die for your right to say whatever you're going to say. The First Amendment, stand there with your signs and your cameras. But once you cross the line to impede, assault, or obstruct federal law enforcement operations, you have broken 18 U.S. Code 111 that makes it a felony to do so. The news we're getting today, obviously, is that Don Lemon, the former CNN anchor, has now been arrested in Los Angeles early this morning. And by all accounts, we don't quite have all of the details of the charges he's going to face, but it looks like he will likely be facing the FACE Act charges, right? This is the Freedom to Access to Church Entrances, which applies to houses of worship as well. And for our listeners, which you well know, Ken, the reason why it's not just clinic entrances, it's also houses of worship, is that was the negotiation that Democrats and Republicans came to, because Republicans wanted it to apply to houses of worship. It's worth noting it was the late Senator Ted Kennedy that put the FACE Act together, a Democrat president, Bill Clinton, that signed it into law back when Democrats supported border enforcement and removing illegal aliens. Now here we are today. Do you think that a FACE charge related type against Don Lemon, and for what he did by charging into that city's church in Minneapolis a while back, do you think this is going to be a problem for him?
It is going to be a problem for him. I watched some of his video. I've been on with Don Lemon years ago when I worked with CNN, and he was the one show I wouldn't go on. And Don was ranting about exercising First Amendment rights, invading a church. No. You have the right to say what you want, but you don't get to disrupt other people's exercise of their worship, which is not coincidentally also First Amendment right. That's disturbing the peace, et cetera, and that's a foundation for a violation of the federal FACE Act, a very controversial law because it has been used in the past to arrest pro-lifers protesting abortion outside abortion clinics. And as you noted, the political deal when that FACE Act was implemented was that it was also going to protect houses of worship. And so it's a rather thoroughly tested, legally tested federal law. So I do think, to your question, Don Lemon is in trouble in terms of his ability or likelihood of being convicted under this. And it'll be delicious to watch his lawyers try to attack the FACE Act as pro-lifers have in the past, with very limited success.
Yeah.
Because it's a legitimate act of federal protection.
It's just a remarkable state of affairs that we live in. And, you know, coming full circle back to the what Tom Homan is trying to do, notwithstanding the comments of Mayor Fry, he's in Washington. Maybe he's, you know, feeling that he needs to make comments like that. But at the end of the day, you know, you well know, because you did this, and I've tried to explain to listeners, because I've spent a lot of time reporting and being out with them, ICE goes out and they have a target list, and every target on that list has a history of either being convicted or facing charges of a crime that is in addition to them crossing the border. That's what Tom Homan is pleading with the Minnesota officials to say, give us your criminals. And he makes the point that if you don't like agents in the street, and of course we had the famous line from Jacob Fry, I want ICE to get the F out. You know, he's saying there will be more ICE agents in the jails, less on the streets, win for everybody. You would think that they would take that offer. We have to wait and see what happens. Ken Cuccinelli, we've got to leave it there, yeah. But thank you for taking time, and have a great weekend, sir.
Griff, good to be with you. Stay warm.
It's a hard thing to do, but we'll try. Thanks, Ken. This is Griff Jenkins filling in on the great Brian Kilmeade Show. We have so much coming your way. Don't go anywhere.
Keeping you informed, engaged, and always a step ahead. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I want you to understand that just as you have come together, there are state prosecutors coming together right now to make sure that people understand there will be accountability. There will be accountability now. There will be accountability in the future. There will be accountability after Trump is out of office. If we have to hunt you down the way they hunted down Nazis for decades, we will find your identities. We will find you. We will achieve justice.
This is Griff Jenkins filling in for the Brian Kilmeade Show, and that was Larry Krasner, the Philadelphia district attorney, talking about ICE, hunting down ICE like Nazis. Unbelievable, claiming that state prosecutors are lining this up. But the governor, Josh Shapiro, talking to Brett Baer on Special Report last night, that's not sitting well. Listen here.
That kind of rhetoric is unacceptable. It is abhorrent, and it is wrong. Period. Hard stop. End of sentence.
So clearly, the governor not agreeing with the George Soros-backed DA there, but this kind of rhetoric is not piping down. This is Griff Jenkins on the Brian Kilmeade Show with a jam-packed show. Do not, I repeat, do not touch that dial.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You were almost with Brian Kilmeade, but he is off today. This is your humble D.C. correspondent, Griff Jenkins, trying to fill the giant shoes of Brian Kilmeade. And it is such an honor right now to have one of the dearest, most amazing people that I've known for years living in D.C., working on the D.C. Bureau, and that is our chief legal correspondent, our Supreme Court guru, and of course, the host of Fox News Sunday, Shannon Bream, out with a brand new book, or coming out in March, Nothing is Impossible with God, Shannon Bream. Hey, Shannon.
Griff, I have to come to New York to see you.
Listen,
D.C. people have to come to New York to see each other. But
we are taking over.
I mean, yes, we're in the New York studio.
Be forewarned, Brian Kilmeade.
Be forewarned. Look out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to get into the book and dive into what's an amazing story that you basically profile the lives of 11 biblical figures and how they have overcome, you know, the challenges like doubt and in loneliness. And it's so inspiring. But I do, because you're our legal beagle, I want to just get your quick thoughts. I was talking in the first 30 minutes of the show, Shannon, with Ken Cuccinelli, talking about what we're seeing in Minneapolis and all that stuff. And of course, the kind of news today is that former CNN anchor Don Lemon was arrested in Los Angeles early this morning. Looks like we're waiting to get sort of all the details on charges. It looks like he'll probably face something related to the FACE Act, mm-hmm. the federal law that protects, of course, access to abortion clinics. But also, as Republicans fought for in that bill back in the 90s, the Ted Kennedy bill signed by Bill Clinton, access to worship, houses of worship. Just your thoughts on you know, Don Lemon, is he facing trouble here?
Yeah, he could be, because remember the DOJ tried to get an arrest warrant for him from a judge in the Minneapolis area last week, and we're told they made an attempt and it didn't happen. But the DOJ said, Harmy Dillon out there heading up the Civil Rights Division, we have other levers. We have other ways we're going to continue to pursue everybody who was involved with that altercation at the church. So she, you know, has made good on that promise now, because a lot of times people get really excited about things they hear from this administration. Then they're frustrated if it doesn't come to fruition. But it looks like here the DOJ is delivering on that promise to get him arrested.
And I'm sure on Fox News Sunday this weekend, you'll probably address what we're seeing happening in Minneapolis. I have said and will continue to say that what Tom Homan did in that press conference was masterclass, by resetting sort of the table by saying, listen, at the end of the day, we're trying to bring the temperature down, but we're also trying to just get you to cooperate. We're not asking you to do federal immigration law enforcement. Mm-hmm. We're asking you to cooperate. And of course, explaining you don't want to see our agents in the streets.
Right.
Well, guess what? More agents in the jails, mm-hmm. in your local jails. Hand over the criminal illegal aliens so that you don't have agents in the street. Are you going to talk about this weekend?
Definitely. And I agree with you. I think they really tried to bring the tone down, bring the temperature down, and say, yeah, if you don't want 3,000 agents there, we don't need that many. If you would let us come to the jails and get people that have ICE detainers on them. And it kind of puts the onus on the left to explain why you wouldn't do that. These are people that are not just, you know, they haven't just violated the law by coming here illegally, but there's some other criminal component to this. And that's the reason ICE says, we're trying to target the worst of the worst. Do the worst first. That's their plan. If not, if, you know, these states and localities want to just release these people without giving ICE a heads up or honoring that detainer, it's going to mean more of them are on the streets, and that means more agents on the streets, and they don't know if somebody's dangerous. If you pick them up at a jail, you know they don't have a gun on them. It's easier for agents, and it's safer for everybody involved. Otherwise, you know, the left's got to defend why they're not for that, because it just leads to more of these agents on the streets and more of these dangerous incursions for both sides of this argument.
Yeah, it is such a good point. You point out that, and Tom Homan walked through this a little bit, it only takes one ICE agent to go into jail, mm-hmm. to take custody of a criminal illegal alien being transferred into federal custody to ultimately be removed from the country, which is what a lion's share of Americans support. They supported it in 2014, and they still support it today. And yet, if they are released, and the administration says 470 criminal aliens were released on Minnesota streets since President Trump took office, they have to do what's called an at-large arrest, mm-hmm. out in the streets. And for every one of those, that's 15 or 16 agents. We'll see where it goes. I can't wait to talk, to watch you cover that on Fox News Sunday. But let's get into this book, because it's amazing for someone who is one of the busiest people at Fox News, from covering the high court to, of course, Fox News Sunday. You have time to write these books. But, you know, it gets back to the older you get, you begin to think, and I think this is true of most people, about what really matters in life. And your book here profiles 11 biblical figures' lives and talks about how working through God, these imperfect people really were able to work through and ultimately accomplish extraordinary things and find extraordinary purpose. Why did you write the book?
These books are such a labor of love for me. I really enjoy doing them. I learned so much, even though I grew up in church and went to, you know, K through 12 Christian school and then a university undergrad, that very faith-based Liberty University. I was one class away from a theology minor. I feel like I should just do it online so I can say I've got a theology minor. So I love these stories and I get so much encouragement. I learn so much new stuff every time I do one of these books, but I wanted to put together this specific collection of people I consider to be overcomers, because all of us have something to overcome. You mentioned doubts and loneliness, and every one of these stories has something different. And sometimes it's a good thing. Like maybe you want to venture into motherhood or launching a new business. It could be something positive, but it still feels like a heavy lift. So, you know, God, in each of these stories, the humans had no way of getting this done by human standards. They were overcome with these enormous odds. And it wasn't that he moved the challenges or the storms out of their lives, but he showed them that he would walk through that with them. So I want people to be encouraged if you need that in this season in your life. But I also want people to be equipped, because there are really practical tools you can take from these stories too about how you gird yourself up and walk through really challenging times.
I don't think you need that extra credit to get a degree in theology.
Maybe they give me some work
life. Liberty, come on. Like, the girl's done enough work here and yet another book.
Some real life credits.
So, you know, one of the things that strikes me too about the book is, so let's talk about the story of Jonah, because, you know, I have kids that are 24, 20, and I see particularly the younger generation and even the teenagers now, because of social media, because of COVID, because of a litany of reasons, there is an epidemic of loneliness, particularly in young people. And you know, the story of Jonah is about loneliness. Talk to me about what we learned from Jonah.
Yeah, and he was somebody too. Some of these biblical characters, they, when God showed up and said, I'm asking you to do this task, they're like, okay, I'm going to walk forward. Or there's Jonah, who was like, no, I'm going in the opposite direction. I don't want to go where you're asking me to go. I don't like that assignment. And he got to spend some time in the belly of a whale. And that's a very lonely place to be. But, you know, I talk about in our lives, sometimes God puts us in a timeout. You know, you can be in that belly of a whale, and it's a place where you can be lonely, but you have to really think about what matters, what he's asking you to do, where you'll find your bravery. And, you know, Jonah came out of that whale, was like, okay, assignment understood. I'm going to go do this now. Another one of the chapters, the one about Elijah, gets into loneliness a lot too. And especially feeling like you're the only person on a specific mission or standing up for something. And so Elijah walks us through too. God showed up every time he was alone and discouraged and said, you're not alone. I'm with you. And there are others who are with you in this too.
You talk about, you know, every time you write one of these books that you call a labor of love. I love it. Like, you know, it really is true in life. If you love what you do, it's not really labor. But you talk about, you know, every time you do it, you learn things. What are some of the things you learned from this experience?
It reminds me that in the darkest times and when you don't understand what's working, there is always a greater purpose. I believe that. And I think the story of Joseph is a really good one too, because if you're familiar with it at all, I mean, he was betrayed at every turn. His own brothers sold him into slavery. He gets falsely accused later and thrown into jail for something he didn't do. I mean, all these things could have made him very cynical and very angry at God, frankly. But at the end, when you see where he was placed, where he ends up in this leadership position in Egypt, where he's able to save all of his brothers in the middle of a famine, that preserves the family that becomes the basis for Israel, for the Jewish people. And what he says to his brothers when they shockingly find out this turn of events is, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. So even when we can't understand why things feel like they're really going wrong, betrayals and other things in our lives, God can use all things for good. And he can put us in a position where he needs us to be, even if we don't understand the journey to get there.
You know, we have all talked about on the air about really there is a bit of a revival of faith in this country, much of it following the tragedy of the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and his widow, Erica Kirk, has really remarkably shown not only strength in a widow that no one would have blamed for curling up in a dark corner and slamming the door shut, but leaned into it. And she has really picked up the mantle of Charlie's evangelizing. People that didn't really follow Charlie didn't really get it. They just saw this rebel rouser of her political correctness and pushing conservatism and free speech on college campuses. But he was doing it while evangelizing. And, you know, ultimately, for people of faith, you realize that God's saying, listen, I want you to do what you're doing, but spread my gospel. It's the only thing I ask of you. And now you do see this sort of revival. And you know, when you write books like this, and it has a practical application to life. I just applaud you for it, because I feel like this book, not to give you just shameless plug, but to be true to and genuine to what I'm getting to, I feel like this is the sort of thing that these young people mm-hmm. in this revival of faith are thirsty and hungry for.
Yeah, I think there's an openness. I think anytime there's tragedy or real chaos or a feeling of disassociation or loneliness, all of those things drive you to look for answers. And I think young people are looking for something authentic. They know that a lot of the life that they see on social media is not achievable. And even if you get there, it doesn't bring happiness. I mean, we see story after story of these influencers whose lives fall apart or they take their own life. I mean, that's not going to answer all of your problems, getting rich or famous. Or any of those things, you know, being rich and famous, Griffith, there are other things to life. There are other things to life. But I think they're really looking for something solid and authentic. And right before Christmas, I did an interview with Erica, and she talked about how, you know, of course she's devastated, of course, but she and Charlie were always of the mindset that their life wasn't their own. It was for God and for his purposes. And I think that gives her a lot of perspective and a lot of strength. We also talked to a lot of young people on these campuses who are turning back to faith or examining faith, these mass baptisms and revivals. I talked to a rabbi who serves on George Washington University's campus and said, yes, people are coming back to their faith. I think young people are looking for something that's solid and comforting in a time of a lot of upheaval.
When you wrote this latest book, what surprised you? Anything that stands out is that...
Well, it's always a reminder to me, like, that I don't always get things right. It's easy to look at these characters and be like, how could they not do what God was asking them to do? But it's always a little bit of a surprise and a slap back in my own face. Like, where have you tried to argue with God? Like, what's even the point in that? Where have you told him, no, my plan is better, as if we know better than God?
Yeah.
So it's always a good, fresh reminder to me that I surprise myself in remembering, like, yeah, you've gotten off the path too. But the good news is, he always welcomes us back. He's always waiting for us.
He is indeed. The book is Nothing is Impossible with God. The author is the Fox News Sunday host, Shannon Bream, joining us in the studio. And so, you know, I think that in this environment where you're seeing this revival of faith, and fortunately we are seeing more books like this, but for someone who is shunned faith, mm-hmm. Maybe a Catholic that strayed from the church, or someone that has never really been a religious person because of their mm-hmm. upbringing out there. What do you say to them? And you know, might reading your book, just to understand some characters mm-hmm. in the Bible that they know their names, mm-hmm. but they don't really understand who they were, you know, would this be something for them?
Yeah. And listen, I get that a lot of people have been hurt by religion or by people within the mantle of claiming religion for a lot of different reasons that they feel rejected or feel like people are hypocrites within the church. So I get that people can be hurt by life circumstances and think, how could God, if there was one, allow this? And struggling with those questions is a very human thing. And many of these characters in the Bible, they struggle. And I say character, but I truly believe these people existed. I think the Bible is the word of God. So in each of these people, we see real existential struggles in arguing with God. And so he can take that. And we can take our questions to him, even if you're a doubter or an agnostic, an atheist. I think it's worth, if you would have an open heart and open mind, just see his grace, how much he loves you. That's woven all throughout this book. Like, he wants to be in relationship with you. And at least if you have an open mind, see what he has to say in the word. And hopefully you'll take encouragement through each of these stories that, okay, there's a bigger purpose. I don't have to run the world. I find that freeing. Like, I'm not in charge. And there is hope beyond what feels very chaotic and very broken right now.
Gosh, you're going to get, you are the theology major. I'm giving you the
credit.
Just
a minor. I'm trying to get to the minor.
I'm giving you the credit. I am not one. I'm just a middle-aged 50-something-year-old guy that the older I get, the harder I lean into my faith. But, mm-hmm. you know, it is important. You got me thinking. It's always important with Christianity that, unlike any other religion, to be a little biased here, Christianity is the only one that doesn't look back on, well, here's a historical figure, and this is what the creed says. This is about living.
Yeah.
This is about now, mm-hmm. not 2,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's about right now and living in the moment and into the future with Christ. And that's why your stories apply to that.
Yeah, it's not just something, as you said, that's historic. But I do love that historical sources outside of the Bible, they confirm the existence of Jesus Christ. And then you have scripture, and there are, every time there's a new discovery, especially in the Holy Land and the Middle East, it backs up what we found out in the Bible, things that they couldn't have understood or known back then. So, but what he wants is now, he wants to walk with you in your exams and your trials in the workplace, your frustrations at home. I mean, he wants to walk with you in all of those things, all the things that were happening in the Bible thousands of years ago. They're happening now. I mean, I talk about in this book about, you know, infertility or being passed over for a job you thought you were going to get, getting a terrible diagnosis, having family conflict. That's all stuff that he walks through then and now. He wants to be with you in that.
He does indeed. We've got to leave it there. Shannon Bream, the title, Nothing is Impossible with God. You can get it now.
You can pre-order now. It comes out March 10th. And Griff, I hope that I get to see you again back in D.C. where we actually live.
I will make it back eventually. Griff Jenkins here with Shannon Bream on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Makes you think, and my brain is exhausted trying to fill the great shoes of Brian Kilmeade. This is Griff Jenkins filling in with you. We just had such an amazing interview with Shannon Bream, the anchor of Fox News Sunday, and of course, our Supreme Court chief legal analyst. And I let her go. She's on a tight schedule with this new book. And I meant to ask her about President Trump making this suggestion of maybe a nomination he one day might make to the high court. Listen here.
Ted Cruz has one thing that I love. If I ever have problems, because it's hard to get people approved, he's a brilliant legal mind. He's a brilliant man. If I nominate him for the United States Supreme Court, I will get 100% of the vote. The Democrats will vote for him because they want to get him the hell out.
I don't know about that, Mr. President. I'm not so sure that you could get him across the finish line. We love Ted Cruz, but I'm not sure he's going to be there. But who knows, you know? The unlikely can always become reality. This is Griff Jenkins on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
This is the great Brian Kilmeade Show, and he gives you fantastic facts and opinion and information. But as your humble D.C. correspondent, Griff Jenkins, I'll at least bring a positive outlook. I just might not be the brightest kid on the block, the kid from Memphis. But fear not, listeners, because fortunately for you, we have one of the smartest guys I know. And when it comes to anything related to business, economy, there is nobody who has a better insight, better sources, better track, or more knowledge than Brian Brenberg. And he is, of course, the host of the Big Money Show that I get to do, along with several other shows he does. But I'm always honored to be sitting with him. And Brian, we want to talk about the news of the day, certainly the economic news of the day.
All right.
And that is President Trump has picked Kevin Warsh to be the next Fed chair.
Right.
Now, you know, for most people not familiar, we know, okay, he's a conservative economist, and we know that he was a wonder kid at 35, becoming the youngest governor to the Federal Reserve under President Bush.
That's wild, by the way.
2006.
35 years old, and you're a governor on the Federal Reserve Board? That's really amazing. I mean, I'm much older than that, and it would be daunting for a guy at my stage in my career to do that. 35, but he's kind of a wonder kid. He's kind of a whiz kid. So that's why he got the job so young.
So what else do we need? I mean, first of all, what do you think of this pick, and who is Kevin Warsh?
Okay, so there's a lot of different directions you can go with this, but let me set it up this way, because if you're following the news about the Fed, all right, and President Trump, you know that President Trump's had a kind of a big tiff with Jerome Powell, the current Fed chair, and he's gone in May, right? So President Trump's got to pick a new guy. And everybody is saying, because the president's very upfront about what he wants with interest rates. Yeah. Okay. He's very clear about that. Everybody is saying, look, he's going to pick a guy who's going to come in there and he's just going to cut interest rates and just do exactly what the president says. He's going to be kind of a lackey at the Fed, and all he's going to do is what the president wants. Okay. So that's what everybody's thinking. That's what all the markets, you know, all the traders and precious metals and bonds,
Elizabeth Warren,
they all think this is what's going to happen. Okay. And instead, I would say, instead, what he does is he picks the guy who, of anybody in the running, by far is the guy who's known as the fiscal hawk, the guy who's more concerned about high inflation than anything, the guy who's most likely to keep interest rates a little higher or raise them if he gets a whiff of inflation, okay? So this guy, so Warsh, if you just look at the historical track record, going back to his days with the Federal Reserve Board that you talked about, and then everything he's said and done since then, this is the guy who's least likely to capriciously cut interest rates. So this is what I think is amusing about this. You get all the president's critics saying he's picking a lackey, and he ends up picking the guy who on paper probably is least likely to just blindly follow what the president wants. And I think that's a good thing. And the market thinks that that's a good thing as well. If you look at some of the indicators, okay, so you watch what people with money on the line do when the president announces this pick.
Yeah.
Here's the number one thing you look at. Look at the price of metals, because in the run-up to President Trump choosing Warsh, all of these gold, silver, platinum, palladium, copper, all the price of all these things went way up. And the reason they go way up, one of the reasons, is because traders are getting nervous about the Federal Reserve. They think they're going to get this lackey who's going to let the money supply run away and interest rates are going to get cut and everything's going to be inflated, right?
Right.
So they bought metals. Well, as soon as he picks Warsh, you know what happened to all those metals? The prices cratered. I mean, they are cratering today, which tells you, this is what it tells you. The guys with money on the line are saying, oh, Trump picked a guy who's going to probably be kind of independent, and he's going to fight inflation, and he's not just going to drop interest rates. So it's so fascinating to me how wrong the critics look right now today when the president chooses Kevin Warsh.
I love that. That is why we have you, Brian Brinberg, who can lay this out unlike anybody else. And I love the fact that it's not even just on this pick. It's like time and time again, you know, we had all of the naysayers saying that the market was going to head to a recession or at least a downturn. Mm-hmm. And yet that's not what we've seen, the GDP growth. But coming back to Warsh, you know, I was, and explain this to me, I was shocked to see that Chevron came out with this, you know, resounding positive statement about the pick. And I guess maybe that's because, you know, my naivety not following it. I'm like, well, it's, you don't really see major corporations, particularly oil and gas, like Chevron, just quickly responding to news things. Normally, as reporters, you got to beat a statement out of them. And even then, after you beat a statement out of them, it says nothing. This statement was really quite flattering.
I think if I took 5 minutes and went through, I could give you at least a dozen huge corporations that have done the same thing.
Wow.
Because I've just been sort of trolling through the, I mean, Tim Cook and Apple came out and did the same thing. UPS did. Now, I think Warsh served on the UPS board at one point, so maybe it makes sense that they would do that. Chevron. Yeah. I mean, again, it's like Trump doesn't do everything perfectly on the economy. I'm not saying that. Okay. But there is this thing that happens. I call it the Trump will wreck everything trade. Okay. And there's this view that like somehow the president is going to wreck everything, right? He's going to wreck everything with tariffs. He's going to wreck everything with his Fed pick. He's going to do something so colossally stupid that it's going to wreck capitalism in America. And it doesn't happen. It's actually the opposite. He right. cuts taxes and the economy booms. He cuts taxes and paychecks rise, right? He produces good results, but people time and again think he's going to wreck everything. So this Fed thing had become, he's going to wreck everything. He's going to destroy Fed independence. And then he doesn't. And all these, you know, everybody breathes a sigh of relief, like, oh my gosh, what a great pick. And it's like, guys, did you think he really wanted to wreck American capitalism?
Yeah.
It's his signature thing, right? Prosperity is his signature thing. So again, it's a little amusing to me to watch the whole world approach Donald Trump and how he makes decisions like it's the first time they've met him. Like, come on, people, we've seen him before. We know how he operates.
Hey, talk to me about the implications of whether Warsh will be able to handle the onset of AI. You know, on the Big Money Show, we talk a lot about AI.
Yeah.
And obviously, where all we know about AI is it's for sure going to fundamentally impact our lives. He is likely to be the Fed chair during the earliest days of the onset of AI, which could be destabilizing to markets. And he may have to factor something in that previous Fed chairs have not really had to worry about.
And he's talked about this pretty explicitly. Now, I want to be clear. He doesn't control AI policy, right?
No,
he shouldn't. He's the Fed, okay?
No.
So it's not his job. But he asked what he says is what AI is likely to do is it's likely to be a very productivity enhancing thing. You produce more with less input, okay? And that is something that fights against inflation. When productivity is high, it brings the price levels down, and so it's a disinflationary thing. So that's important, because what he is saying is we're entering an economy that could grow fast and be very productive, and that's disinflationary, so you don't need to keep interest rates super high in that environment, right? Because inflation is likely to generally be low there. So he's making the case, let's not think that a fast-growing economy is somehow a risk to more inflation, and therefore we need to keep interest rates really high. He critiques the Fed. He says the Fed right now thinks that way, and it's a problem because every time the economy starts growing, they think, well, we got to raise interest rates. He says that's the wrong way to think. It misunderstands what AI can do, what effect it's going to have on inflation, and therefore where we should keep interest rates. So he doesn't control AI policy, but I think what's going to happen with him is the Fed's going to recognize how powerful AI is to help us produce more with less, and you're going to see an interest rate policy that doesn't try to crush that, but tries to enable it. And I think that the side benefit of that is it will create the kind of economy where people whose jobs are affected by AI in a growing economy can find new opportunities more easily. And that's a good thing, in my view, because that's the big challenge of AI is figuring out how to adapt to it as a worker.
Well, it's really insightful to hear you talk about how he thinks about it and clearly may be the perfect guy for the job. I want to let you go, but I'm sure you're going to talk maybe about this on Big Money Show.
Oh, we're going to be all over this. I think there's going to be a lot of debate about it. You've kind of heard my perspective on it, but we got five people on the panel, so we're going to debate that. We're going to talk about all the earnings news, what's going on in the stock market. This is a big Friday for business news, so you should definitely check out the Big Money Show at noon.
Brian Brimberg, right. Nobody better. Thanks for being
man.
Here.
Good to see you.
And this is Griff Jenkins on the Brian Kilmeade Show. We got a whole lot more when we come back.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Oh, how time flies on the great Brian Kilmeade Show. This is Griff Jenkins filling in for Brian Kilmeade. And because Brian is a sports fan and myself an NFL avid viewer, I must take a moment, friends, to lose my ever-loving mind. I just don't know how else to put it. Because when we got news that legendary coach Bill Belichick was going to be snubbed by the Hall of Fame, the Pro Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio, he failed to get the necessary 80% or 40 out of 50 votes to be inducted on a first ballot. The world of football lost it. For good measure, because, you know, you wonder what any Hall of Fame would be the merits. Why would someone be in a Hall of Fame? Why would a guy like Bill Belichick be allowed on the first ballot to become enshrined in the Hall of Fame of pro football? Well, maybe because he won 8 Super Bowls, 6 with the New England Patriots, 2 as a defensive coordinator to the Giants. Maybe because he won 333 football games over his career. It was a 333-178 winning record, which is second in history, only to Don Shula, the Miami Dolphins legendary quarterback, who, by the way, enshrined in the Hall of Fame. He won more conference championships, playoff championships in games than any other coach. And yet here is a guy that is being denied. And the Hall of Fame, by the way, in reacting, decided to not try and explain it away, but rather got angry that the news got out, because they wanted it to be held until February 5th, when it's traditionally announced who it is that's gotten into the Hall of Fame. I don't know if they're not paying any attention, or this is some sort of ridiculous joke that they're playing, but they have upset the football world. The football world is aghast that this would happen. But it's not just fans like me. It is, of course, the GOAT, the greatest of all times, the quarterback that won those six Super Bowl rings with Bill Belichick. Tom Brady wasted no time speaking out about his disgust. Listen here.
I don't understand it. I mean, I was with them every day. If he's not a first ballot Hall of Famer, there's really no coach that should ever be a first ballot Hall of Famer, which is completely ridiculous because people deserve it. And
yeah, really. Tom Brady has such a good point. If not Bill Belichick, then who? Who would ever get in on a first ballot if not one of the winningest coaches in history? And people have tried to say, well, maybe it was because of the Deflategate, Spygate scandals, or maybe it's because he wasn't friendly to the media. Remember, many of those that are on this commission that elect who gets into the Hall of Fame are sports writers. There's a few coaches, but most are sports writers. Maybe they didn't like the way the guy treated them. But yet, if that's the case, they can't look past their bias and allow politics to play into it, to not give someone their due by their accomplishments, by their merits, by becoming what Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, has called the greatest coach of all time. And when a guy like Robert Kraft makes a statement like that, that is saying something in the history of great coaches. And yet you have smart people like Stephen A. weighing in about, you know, what all this means and why this would have happened. Listen here.
Now let me say this to everybody about the Pro Football Hall of Fame. We should boycott that bad boy. Nobody should want to go into that Hall of Fame if Bill Belichick ain't in as a first ballot Hall of Famer. Six championships as a head coach. 8 overall, 2 as a defensive coordinator, universally recognized as arguably the greatest coach in the history of football. If it's going to be because of Spygate, if it's going to be because of Deflategate, are you going to use that excuse to keep Tom Brady out as a first ballot Hall of Famer next?
Well, exactly, Stephen A. And, you know, as I'm talking about this, my blood is boiling because, you know, at the end of the day, whether it's football or another professional sport that fans have been loyal to for decades, that have spent their hard-earned money to support, to go to games. I'm a Commanders fan. God love them. They had a great season last year. Not so good this year. We'll be back, by the way. But I spent money I didn't have to go see them play in Philadelphia. They lost, by the way, playing the Eagles in the divisional championships last year. For all of those thousands, millions of fans that support this, they understand apparently what the idiots in Canton, Ohio at the Pro Football Hall of Fame don't understand, that it's always about the game. And when it's always about the game, politics set aside, biases set aside, what matters is the gridiron, the game. And you cannot argue with the fact that in our modern lives, for anyone 50 years and younger, no one has been more successful. No one has played the game, or in this case, coached the game better, more successfully than Bill Belichick. with a quarterback you just heard speaking out there, Tom Brady. And Stephen A. has a great point. If you're not going to let Belichick in the Hall of Fame on the first ballot, then how do you let Tom Brady in on the first ballot? If it's tied to something like Deflategate and Spygate, which is preposterous in and of it. And I think while I am entertaining you, perhaps listening, driving around going, man, Griff's losing his damn mind. You bet I am, because this is ridiculous. Football matters to fans like me and the millions across the country, and to Brian Kilmeade and to Stephen A. and of course to the GOAT, Tom Brady. And by the way, all of the names of the people that vote in the Hall of Fame, that's a secret ballot. I say it's time to make it public. I want to know who they are. Name their names. If you're going to do this, don't be a coward. Step forward.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Oh, this is going to get you talking, okay. Let me tell you what. This is Griff Jenkins filling in for the Brian Kilmeade Show, and we cannot on this busy Friday news day ignore this story out of Orlando, Florida. A couple is suing their fertility clinic after an alleged embryo mix-up resulting in the birth of a non-Caucasian baby. The photo has gone viral. It is Tiffany Score and Stephen Mills, the couple that are white. They're a white couple, and they have a clearly, you can see, black child. And while the couple says that they love this child, obviously Tiffany gave birth to this child, there are so many questions. They are worried about what happened to perhaps her embryos that she had stored back in 2020. And of course, whether or not the biological parents of this child could come looking one day. Dana Marie McNichol, our Miami Fox News correspondent, has been covering this story. She covered it for us on Fox and Friends this morning, continuing to do it all day. And you know, Dana Marie, this story is just you. There's so many questions. It's hard to know where to even begin. Explain to us really what is it about this case? How did this happen, and where does it stand?
Hey, Griff, thank you so much for having me. Right. I mean, the story captivated us right from the beginning for, you know, so many different reasons. You see the picture, you feel for the family. And when speaking to the attorney, we got a lot of information and a lot of insight on exactly what is going on. I can say first that they don't know exactly what happened. The Stephen Mills and Tiffany Score, that's why they decided to sue this fertility center of Orlando. So on December 11th, this baby was born. They clearly noticed that this does not resemble either of them. They quickly did the genetic testing. They realized that shocking truth. And they have fallen in love with this baby. This is their child. The attorney said, this is their daughter. They want to keep this baby. They want to raise this baby, but they're living in fear, especially because the law doesn't necessarily protect them. The attorney says that this is a really unregulated space in the law, especially in Florida. There's a lot of protections around surrogates and parents who go through the surrogacy space, but not necessarily through IVF. So there's a lot of gray space here that, like you mentioned, they're wondering who are the genetic parents and where are their own embryos. So we spoke to the attorney, Mara Hatfield. I want to toss that soundbite because she kind of explains the questions surrounding it. Let's take a listen.
The interesting question becomes, what are the rights that they, as the biologically nurturing now 10-month parents, have versus the rights of the genetic parents that they hope to identify? And that is very much a developing question that the law is trying to answer, because unfortunately, these mistakes very, very rarely happen, but they do happen.
Yeah. You know, that you did such a great interview, Dana Marie, because we don't know. So the biological parents could have stored embryos at the clinic as well. They may or may not be, in the stage of life as well. But yet at the same time, your attorney, Mara Hatfield, pointing out that there's really not much of precedent to deal with. So what happens when the biological parents find out and they come knocking on the door if Tiffany and Stephen, you know, are raising this child that they love? And for all we know, they may believe that, you know, this is one of those moments in life when they realize this is what God decided. They wanted to plant this, you know, child in this family. But yet, from a legal standpoint, if a biological parent came knocking on the door, might they have a legal claim for that child, which would be devastating to Stephen and Tiffany? And then the other flip side of the coin is it appears that Stephen and Tiffany have no idea whether or not another couple might be pregnant with or currently raising a child from the embryos that Tiffany stored back in 2020 with the clinic.
That's right. And that's why they took this to court. The attorney did mention that the fertility clinic was not really playing game. They weren't cooperating until they threatened this lawsuit, which is wild. But what the couple is asking is they're asking for complete transparency with patients that have their embryos stored in the same fertility clinic, so other people know exactly what happened, and then pay for two type of genetic testing for any of those children that were born within the last 5 years. So essentially, they're also trying to protect other parents to see if this could happen again. And this is just the first layer of the lawsuit. I said, hey, we're not hearing anything about money. They're just asking for these first steps to happen. Why is that? Are you going to bring a civil lawsuit? And she said, absolutely. This is some of the things that we have to do before to make sure we understand what happened, where things went wrong, and then we can ask for those damages. I do want to make sure I get in that statement from the Orlando Fertility Clinic.
Yeah, please.
They did say they are now actively cooperating with this investigation. We support this patient. They say, quote, all parties are working diligently to help identify when and where the error may have occurred. Our priority remains transparency and well-being of the patient and child involved. So so it seems like they are now working through the process of figuring out how to remedy this as it moves forward. I know this couple is struggling. You know, it's so shocking. It's a time when they, the attorney said they want to be joyful, and they are joyful, but now they're having to tell their family and friends. Now this is a major national story that's on the front page of so many different news headlines. And so here at Fox and the journalist team in Miami, we feel for them. We're hoping we can, you know, continue to tell their story. And we know this baby is such a blessing. And it's a wild journey to share with all of us and you at home.
As you know, to that point, I mean, listen, I'm a parent. I have two daughters in their 20s. And I remember, obviously, with my wife, you know, the anxieties of just a healthy baby that come with just the normal best case scenarios. This is clearly one of the worst case scenarios. And now being a brand new parent with so many unanswered questions, did the attorney you spoke to relay, you know, how Tiffany and Stephen are doing? What's their mental state? How are they handling this? How is it impacting them?
Yeah, she mentioned it's a very emotional time for them. Tiffany did post on Facebook yesterday a beautiful post, a couple of photos of their daughter, and just especially saying we love her. We want to do what's best for her. Again, there's just so much uncertainty. I think that's really what the attorney said multiple times in the interview, is the uncertainty, the fear that somebody, a family, could at any point in time come into their life and have and want their own daughter. So like you mentioned, you can't even imagine what it's like postpartum, 1 month, having this baby, and then all of this surrounding it. So they're in this legal battle that they want answers. And so that's what they're working through right now. The judge ordered an emergency hearing to get things going so the fertility clinic could get some answers. But the attorney did mention that one of those genetic tests could take a little bit of time. So we'll see. We're going to be covering this very closely. Of course, when that photo came out, you can see how much that baby loves the parents. The attorney even mentioned that regardless of the genetics, that baby is connected to that couple. That's their parents. And you could clearly see it when interacting with them. So, yeah. I mean, I think we're all just as stunned as them watching this story.
It's interesting. So, and I know you will do such a yeoman's job, a great job of covering this as it goes forward. And you mentioned kind of the timeline here. So we expect the court proceedings to pick up kind of quickly. And I don't want to put you on the spot here. I've just got about 45 seconds left here. But any indication as to sort of the direction in the court path this may take, like what we can expect will develop next?
You know, the attorney, she does. So we do know they confirmed that the fertility clinic has agreed to that preliminary testing. So the things that they're asking for in this stage of the hearing, they seem like they're cooperating with. Now, a civil lawsuit is completely different. They have to file that separately. Yeah. So, you know, this could take years, Griff.
It could. Know? Oh, these poor parents. Unbelievable. Dana Marie McNichol, Miami Bureau, Fox News correspondent. You're doing a great job covering it. Tune into Fox and check her out. Dana Marie, thank you so much. This is Griff Jenkins filling in for Brian Kilmeade. When we come back, General Jack Keane and what's going to happen in Iran.
Unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
And speaking of breaking news, this is Griff Jenkins filling in for the Brian Kilmeade Show, and that's not the breaking news. The news is, of course, tensions rising with Iran. Earlier this morning on Fox and Friends, I spoke to four-star general, retired Jack Keane, about where things stand with President Trump's stern warning towards Iran.
Mr. President, have you had any conversations with Iran in the last few days, and are you planning on any?
I have had, and I am planning on it, yeah. We have a lot of very big, very powerful ships sailing to Iran right now, and it would be great if we didn't have to use them.
Can you say what the message was that you shared with Iranians?
Well, I told them two things. Number one, no nuclear, and number two, stop killing protesters. But they're going to have to do something.
Mr. President, will you invite Mayor Fry to the White House?
Nobody's seen anything.
President Trump sharing his message to Iran as a new report reveals Saudi Arabia and Israeli officials will be meeting with the Trump administration to talk possible U.S. strikes on Iran. Here to discuss, retired four-star general, Fox News senior strategic analyst and chairman of the Institute for the Study of War, General Jack Keane. General, good morning. Thank you for being here. Obviously, we are seeing the president's message there. Where do you see things standing?
Well, certainly people are talking about negotiations, but I don't think it's realistic given the Iranians. I mean, the Ayatollah himself is so diabolical, so committed, you know, to the ideals that he's trying to establish. You know, he wants to dominate and control the Middle East and export his radical form of fundamentalist Islamic terrorism to the world. I mean, they haven't changed one bit. They still want to pursue a nuclear weapon. They still want to support the proxies that are in the region to destabilize the region and take down Israel. And they have a ballistic missile program that is growing every single day, obviously that threatens Israel and potentially our bases in the region. And that's where they are. He has emissaries that talk nice to our people, but that's where the leadership really is. And they've been like this for 45 plus years. I mean, I got to give them this. They have been consistent throughout that time frame. Objectives are dominate and control the region, drive the United States military out of the region. That's why they've been killing us by the hundreds, actually over a couple thousand plus since 1982 to the present. This is Americans now. And certainly destroy the state of Israel. And you've seen their attempts at doing that. They have not changed one iota. And if they say, oh, we're going to make a deal over nuclear, we all know what that means. Lie and cheat. Lie and cheat, because that's what they have done. And that's why the military option is on the table. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's the most likely that we're going to execute.
And we just had up on the screen a map of the force posture we have there a lot of capabilities there. And we know that obviously aircraft and other assets, including 30 to 40,000 troops in the region, should there be some sort of desperate act. And you talk about the emissaries talking nice, but we did have yesterday a high-ranking advisor to Ayatollah Khamenei saying this, a limited strike is an illusion. Any military action by the U.S. from any origin and at any level will be considered an act of war, and the response will be immediate, all-out, and unprecedented, targeting the heart of Tel Aviv and those supporting the aggressor. That's a bit telling, General, because I think it suggests that if we do indeed take action, that they will then seek, in some part of a desperation measure, try and destabilize the region.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, yeah, that kind of rhetoric, it shouldn't surprise us. I mean, but when you look at the hard cold facts here, Iran has never been weaker than they are right now. In their entire history, since this regime took power in 1980, politically, economically, and militarily. And we have an opportunity here to really set some conditions for the eventual regime collapse. And that's why the military option is on the table, and that's why it's being considered, certainly, by the United States and Israel, and so hopefully supported by allies in the region as well, despite all the public rhetoric to the contrary, that this option really does make some sense. You know, taking action against the leaders there, taking action against the forces that are repressing the people and hold them accountable for the thousands that they've killed. I mean, Griff, listen, they have never killed as many of their own citizens in their history as they have done right now. And in their history, they have never locked up summarily in a matter of a week or two as many citizens as they have, somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 40,000. And when the spotlight is off, they will begin executing them by the hundreds and into the thousands. Why do we know that? Because that's what they have done in the past. So the opportunity is here. Certainly, there's always unknowns about military operations. There's always risk associated with military operations. But the fact of the matter is, when you look at the cost-benefit analysis, the opportunity to put the regime on a path to collapse, an opportunity we haven't had like this in all of these years. So despite their rhetoric, do they have capability to retaliate? Yes, they do. They do have missiles. Likely, that's one of the reasons why we've been moving all of these additional resources in, not just to conduct a effective offensive campaign against them, certainly in terms of leaders and other targets that we can take down, but also we know they're going to retaliate. We want to have air defenses there to protect ourselves in the region, bases, and also to help protect the Israelis. They have their own, but we complimented them before during the 12-day war. And also this, a very important target, is the one military capability that they have that we pay attention to. We took away their nuclear capability, obviously, is their ballistic missiles. The Israelis did not destroy all of their launch systems and not all of their missiles when the war ended after 12 days. And they've been recovering that. So likely one of the reasons why the additional resources have been brought in is not just for better defense, but also offensively to take down those missiles quite significantly and take away that capability that they're holding there as leverage. So, yeah, this is the path I think we're on, and certainly these options are going to be executed, I think, sooner rather than later, given now the our resources are in the region, they're being positioned. Being in the region is one thing. Being in position to conduct a military operation with the exact positioning of each ship, the submarines, et cetera, that's quite another. And I'm assuming that is what has taken place.
And at a time when, as you point out so rightfully, General, that the regime has never been weaker, the fall of a regime that has reigned terror since 1979, that would be so historic. General Jack Keane, thank you for taking time. Great insight. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too, Griff. Thanks a lot. And you and the team have a wonderful weekend.
That was retired General Jack Keane, Fox News contributor, and such great insight there, talking about the fact that the Iranian regime has never been weaker. And President Trump clearly sending signals that he may be actually about to strike. General Keane there saying that it could be sooner rather than later. And of course, the amount of firepower in the region. We'll have to watch over the weekend to see where it goes. This is Griff Jenkins filling in on the Brian Kilmeade Show.